When she was 18, her father gave her the advice she needed to follow her dreams and become a writer. The next day, he had a heart attack and died in her arms. She did become a writer and a business owner and then a wife and mother. Today, after 13 books, a million of them in print, she's an award-winning syndicated columnist, a radio and TV host, and the owner of two successful companies. And now, Elise is here to help you rebuild your life. Stay tuned. This is gonna be good. This is the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome back to the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours. Our number, lines are wide open, so if you're always wondering when to call, now is the right time to call. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. Follow me on Twitter, at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K. A real estate person named Michelle on Twitter just asked me a question, do looks matter in real estate? And I thought that was sort of interesting because I wonder if she's asking, and this is, you know, what the question of the day, right? Does she mean, does the house have to look good or the real estate agent? Maybe she means the mortgage broker. Maybe we should all just put on Halloween masks and look really scary because that's how the market looks. I don't know. Anyway, we're talking about real estate today and mortgage interest rates, which are again dropping just a bit to about 4% for a 30-year fixed, which is incredible. And where I want to start today is IRS phone scams, because out of the blue, there has been so much news on identity theft just this week, holiday week, traffic's been down, people are off, some, you know, kids have gone back to school, parents are off, but what's going on with all of these phone scams, phishing and vishing and all the rest? Well, the new flavor of the week, there's been two big things that have happened. One is that it looks like Russian hackers have hacked into J.P. Morgan Chase and three other enormous banks. So you've got to wonder if it's just Wells Fargo and Citi and I don't know who the other one would be. But, you know, if not, the idea is that it's J.P. Morgan Chase and four other banks or three other banks. And that's really scary because officials say that data on millions and millions of people could have been compromised. It doesn't look like anybody's tried to make a move with that data yet, and yet the data has been compromised. We don't even know what that means exactly, but, you know, not a good idea. And you get the usual information and advice in the media, which is go change your passwords, and we'll talk about what passwords maybe should be right now in just a minute. So you got to change your password, and you've got to make sure that everything's secure and all the rest of it. You've got to update your antiviral software. But I have to tell you, as good as the antiviral software is, and frankly, I'm sure our office buys as good as it gets, it's McAfee or the, you know, any of the other similar sort of brands. But you've got people who can hack into banks. And so bank software, bank online protection is, In the U.S., I can't speak to other places, from what I know, and I've talked to some of the leading cybersecurity experts in the country, is supposed to be about as secure as it gets. And yet, it seems routinely that people are able to hack in, and I'm not sure if it's because they have people on the inside that are making it easy for them, or they're just that smart. What I always say to my kids is, I wish hackers like this would just take all this stuff that they know how to do and just use it for good, because we would be so much further along, but whatever. Meanwhile, the other big scam, identity theft protection scam that's going on right now, is that con artists are posing as IRS agents, and that's back in the news. And government officials have been saying that taxpayers aren't understanding that there are real dangers to answering people's phone calls or emails and providing information, that people are too easily fooled when somebody says that they are from the IRS, you believe them. Don't believe them. Now, I know everybody who listens to my show and Clark Howard's show, you guys aren't this gullible, but you may have family members, children, grandparents, relatives, friends who are completely gullible, because 90,000 complaints have been received in less than a year, according to the Treasury Inspector General for Tax Administration, which is TIGTA, TIGTA.gov. 90,000 complaints. Of the 90,000 complaints, 1,100 victims have lost about $5 million that they know of. 90,000 complaints. So what's happening here? People are calling they're claiming to be from the IRS. They are claiming that you either owe money or you're entitled to a big refund. So it always has to do with money. Callers might use phony names and give you a fake IRS badge number. They may know your last four digits of your Social Security number. And then they're going to ask you for information that's going to compromise your security. That's what they're going to do. And please, you can't do this. You cannot give them any information. You just need to hang up. Don't worry about being polite to them. Don't feel like you have to talk in full sentences. Just say no and delete the emails. Now, when you get this kind of information, you have to really understand that the IRS will never, never, in all the years that I've been writing about money and real estate and hosting this radio show and filling in for Clark Howard, the IRS has clearly said, we will never ask you for credit card information, debit card information, or prepaid card information over the phone. The IRS will never insist you use a specific payment method. They will never demand immediate payment over the phone. They just won't. That is not how the IRS operates. They send you a written letter that looks like a pre-printed form letter. And you should be suspicious of any other kind of contact, right? It's a big red flag, or it should be, that you're going to get an angry, threatening call from people who say they're the IRS and you have to pay immediately now, right now over the phone, they're going to take your house. Or they're going to, you know, garnish your wages or whatever they say they're going to do. It isn't going to happen. And yet 90,000 people have had something like this happen to them over the last 9 months. So if this happens to you and you get a phone call like this, you should hang up. You could also go to TIGTA.gov, which is the Treasury Inspector General for Tax Administration, or to IRS.gov. On the TIGTA site, there's a link that says IRS Impersonation Scam Reporting. Okay, you can go there. You can also go to IRS.gov, and you can make a claim there. You can also go to the Federal Trade Commission using the FTC Complaint Assistance, FTC.gov, and just include the words when you file a complaint, IRS telephone scam. You can call the IRS at 800-829-1040 if you think you might owe taxes. You can call, and the IRS will, right there, look up your account. You're calling the IRS so it's safe. You know what your taxpayer identification number is, and you give it to them. So that's safe. You can call TIGTA, TIGTA, and you can at 1-800-366-4484, and you can do the same thing. And then there's the Federal Trade Commission. So there are all sorts of ways to report a scam. And if you're going to do the FTC one and you get one as an email threatening the same things, you can copy the email and put it into the complaint notice and send that off. Now, the FTC will not get back to you directly. That's just not their MO. What they do is they look at patterns and trends across the country. They don't investigate individual reports. They look at where they're seeing patterns and trends, and then they put investigative units on it. They collect it from different things, and they try to look for where these are all coming from to pinpoint who it is. But the IRS may do more investigation, or TIGTA may do some investigation. But in any case, the best thing that you can do is to protect yourself. And how do you protect yourself? You never give this kind of information out over the phone. It just seems, here we are in 2014, and I'm just stunned that people are still doing this. So the big takeaway here is that these kinds of scams are ongoing, and you need really good information to understand how to avoid it, how to protect yourself, and to really understand just how to protect your family. So one of the websites that we do some content marketing work for is a website called identityprotection.com. There are a number of these sites out there. This one is powered by Equifax. And all it is about identity theft protection. And there's a lot of information on there about this kind of thing. And you can sign up for a newsletter. It'll send it out once a month, tell you about the latest scams that are going on out there. There are so many different things that you need to protect yourself against. It's just really scary. And it's kind of interesting because it makes me think about sort of where we are in technology and how advanced we're getting and yet how much more at risk we are. Today I saw a story about how the optimal length of a password that can actually protect you, a real password, should be at least 24 characters long. Think about that. 24 characters long. And what does that actually do? Well, what they say is that when you have a password that's 24 characters long, that includes capitalized letters and small case letters, that includes odd sorts of characters like a dollar sign or a pound sign or an exclamation point and actual numbers in it, and it's 24 characters long, it will take a supercomputer upwards of 40 years to run all the possible combinations. That is the fastest computer around today, a supercomputer. It'll take it 40 years to run the combinations. That's the kind of security that you need to do. And I am seriously going to have a conversation with Sam at the end of the show today as we're driving to a wedding in Wisconsin to talk about how we need to lengthen our passwords and strengthen them. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. We've got lines open. Happy to take your calls about money, real estate, identity theft protection, and whether real estate agents have to look good in order to sell your house. On the Elise Klink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB. It's 25 minutes past the hour on the Elise Klink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB. The number 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. Online all the time, the website's thinkglink.com, thinkglink.com. And check out expertrealestatetips.com. It's the name of my YouTube channel and another website where we are putting up all kinds of information, so expertrealestatetips.com and thinklink.com. So we just had a couple of calls asking again about, just go over one more time, why 24-character passwords seems to make sense. And so according to an article on Fox News today and foxbusiness.com, there are, if you have a password, right, about that is 24 characters long, includes upper and lowercase letters, numbers, and other kinds of characters like the pound sign or a dollar sign or a percent sign, that it would take a supercomputer, it's one of the fastest computers out there, over 40 years to run all the possible combinations, which makes it really safe and secure. So the odds are that it could find it sooner, I suppose, but if they're going to run all the combinations to find yours, and you've done it that long, it's going to take 40 years. The other key component to a really solid and protected online identity is to have a really strong username. And your username is like your code name. Your email address is a bad one. Your real name is a bad one. But the article talks about, and I've seen this before, that really good, solid usernames are easy to remember for you, but they have nothing to do with who you are. They might be Landshark or Ninja Smoke or Blackjack or whatever, Starbucks. You can add that to six other words. It could be earthwindandfire.com. So when you're looking at it, it's a two-part system. And as hackers get better and better, and as our financial information becomes more of a target because everything we do is online, you've got to take the care that you can to protect yourself and your financial information. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. I'm Elise Klink, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB. It's 12:36 on the Elise Kling Show, Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB. Happy Labor Day, everybody. It's a nice holiday weekend. Our number, 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. Happy to take your questions. Some of the lines are open. We're going to start taking calls now, 404-872-0750. Alan joins me on the line. Hey, Alan.
Hi,
happy
there.
Labor Day weekend.
It's good. I'm working, so I have no problems.
Hey, me too.
I have a question. My family got together, and we had a death in it, and then all of a sudden everybody starts asking, well, we've left you at our will. How would you like your money? Would you like a one lump sum, or would you like it paid out like $13,000 a year so you don't have to pay the inheritance tax? My question is, how much is the inheritance tax, and what's the benefit of taking it and keeping it in one chunk?
All right, Alan, you're fading a little bit, but I think you asked me how much is the inheritance tax, and for you, it's zero. You don't have to pay the money comes to you. So inheritance tax is different from other kinds of taxes, and it's paid out of the estate. You don't owe inheritance tax. No matter how you get your money, you're not going to owe inheritance tax. If you get it in a lump sum or not. And it doesn't even kick in until in excess of $5 million.
Wow.
So
okay.
The people who... So now my question to you is, who the heck is running this estate?
Well, it's my aunts and uncles. They went to call a lawyer, and they said, look, would you... Somehow they figured out that their tax is going to be paid if it's all paid in one lump sum. They said they can take it and break it down to like $13,000 a year and pay it out of an account, and that way they don't have to pay as many taxes or anything.
It's completely wrong. So either they're getting absolutely horrible, inaccurate advice, or you have misheard everything they're telling you. One of the two things has to be true.
The first one.
I'm just saying it's got to be one of the two. First of all, the number 13,000 is really interesting because that's what the amount that you can give any one person without triggering a taxable event with the gift tax, not inheritance tax, gift tax, used to be 13,000. Now I think it's 14,500. May even be for next year 15,000. I have to look and see where the number is. So that number's not even an accurate number. The concept that they're trying to get to, which is to not have an inheritance tax or a gift, is separate from gift tax. So who died? Let's start there.
Well, no one has died yet. My uncle passed away about 2 months ago.
Okay.
And my aunts and uncles all got together, and they said, okay, we're going to redo the wills and find all, and they've been...
Was he an exceptionally... let me ask. Alan, was he an exceptionally wealthy man?
No, he's not average. I mean, you know, he's not in the millions, but he's definitely not poor.
Okay. So let's... If he doesn't have $5 million... If he died, did he have more than $5 million in cash investments in property?
Well, if he passed... Well...
The uncle who died.
Yeah, well, he's less than $5 million.
He left them $5 million total.
No, he's less than $5 million.
Less than $5 million. Okay.
My aunt, she has probably $300,000.
Okay. So let me just start.
And house and properties and stuff like that.
Okay.
Said, you know, when
everything all in, is she over $2
million? No.
Okay. There is no estate tax, federal estate tax, for estates of under $2 million. Zero.
Okay.
So anybody who tells them that they're going to have to pay an estate tax is incorrect.
Okay.
So, so that's the bottom line there. So the first thing I would say is, Auntie, I'm not sure you're getting really good legal advice. How about if we find a competent estate attorney and you could ask some questions to them, but... Elise Glink on the radio said that there's no federal estate tax due on estates less than $2 million.
Okay, that's good information. Honestly, I really didn't know that. I've always wondered about that, and it's just like, you're the first person that actually told me what it was supposed to be. But trust me, after I hang up with you, I'm calling my aunt.
So let me ask the next question. So your aunt, does she have any children?
No.
So how many siblings? There's three of you, and she's going to leave you guys all the money?
Yeah, she split it three ways and spread it out between the three boys.
So the three of you guys are going to inherit maybe $100,000 to $200,000 each?
Yes.
You should take it all in a lump sum, and you should tell her that there, you know, and I don't know, maybe she's got like a deep oil well somewhere that you don't know about, but precluding that, you know, you should tell her that there is no, she doesn't have to, and this is my concern, because I started the show talking about scams. So it could be that she has run into a lawyer who's not, either not really a lawyer or an investment professional who's not very ethical and honest, who is trying to retain control over these investments as long as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And so what he or she, this investment person, is trying to tell your, convince your aunt to do is to give him the money and he'll dole it out for the next however many years while he bleeds it dry with fees that need not be paid. I don't know that that's what's happening, but I imagine because the advice is so wrong that it's possible that that's what's happened. So you really have to sit down with your aunt and say, I was listening to a Lisa Ling's show. I now have gone to IRS.gov, which you can do, and you can read about the estate tax. Just type in estate tax IRS.gov into a Google search engine, and it'll pull up the exact information that you need. And you can say to her, listen, here is what you really need to know about the estate tax. And here's, I've printed it up for you. And here's what you need to know. Here's the difference between estate taxes and gift taxes. And here's how it actually works. How can we help you make these decisions, get it on paper so that when you die, and we hope it's not for a really long time, and we hope that you use up all your money then before it happens, but when you die, that the money actually goes to the people you want it to go to. And I say this with great love and respect, and not because I hope to get any of this someday, Auntie, but I just don't want you to get bad advice.
I agree with that. Like I said, I told her I didn't want the money. I wanted her around.
Of course. I would trade all the money my mother got.
I
would, listen, Alan.
Forever.
Right. I mean, I would trade all the money my mother got when my father died for one more week with him. And so would she. And so would anybody else who has a loving, supportive person in their life. Of course. But you don't always get that decision.
But that was a question they were asking me, and I was kind of confused by it. So that's, I heard y'all were talking about it today, so I decided to call and ask. So
well, when I
my questions.
When I type in IRS.gov estate tax into a Google search engine, it brings up the whole thing about IRS estate tax information, and it brings up a form that you can walk through that looks at estate taxes. What is the, what, which estates must file taxes? How do you file? Where do you file? And it brings up all the information on IRS.gov. And if you look at estate and gift taxes, which are actually two sides of the same coin, and I can put the form out there, but it's very easy to understand. You know, when you have the information and you read it and it's not that hard, you can understand what you need to tell your aunt so that she ends up putting the right forms into place. And that's the whole thing. That's what we want you to do.
Well, it wasn't just her. It was, they, I hate to say this, the ladies got together and started discussing this.
Which were all of the aunts or just the one aunt? All the aunts. Oh, no.
I have to make one phone call. I have to make a few phone calls after this. But it's just, you know, one bit of bad information. It's amazing how fast it spreads, and everybody believes it. It's just mind-boggling sometimes. So,
all right. Well, let me just tell you that. Let me just give you the numbers one more time. Form 706 is estate and gift taxes on the IRS.gov. The exclusion amount that you can exclude from taxes, from estate taxes, is $5.34 million in 2014. $5,340,000. So any estate that is below that amount, or that amount or below, is exempt from federal estate taxes. The annual exclusion amount for gifts was in 2009 to 2012 was 13,000. This year, it's 14,000.
Okay.
14,000 can transfer to anybody at any time for without triggering any sort of tax. But if she has an estate that's less than that, it doesn't matter. Now maybe what she wants to do, Alan, is she wants to do what my mother's done, which is to see her money getting spent while she's still alive. And maybe she wants to give you a gift at you and your brothers every year. If she does, all she has to do is make out the check for $14,000 to you, to your brothers, and there are no gift taxes, no estate taxes. And she can do that as often as she likes. And if you're married and your brothers are married, she can write you a check for $14,000 and your spouse a check for $14,000.
If you have two relatives that are doing that, do you have to, are each one of them, are they combined, or are they...
You can write it, let's say you have a joint checking account, so let's say she and, let's say your uncle was still alive, and the two of them wanted to make a gift to you, they could make a gift to you for $28,000, and to your wife another $28,000.
Oh, okay.
14 and 14.
Well, I was about to say, my aunt wants to give me $13,000, and my mom wants to give me $13,000.
That's totally fine. They can each actually give you $14,000.
Okay, well, I'm stuck on 13.
Whatever amount they want to give you. But those amounts are just fine. If you're married, they can each give you and your spouse up to $14,000 without triggering any sort of tax. But
and
there's really no, you know, when you're below this $5.34 million level for this year, which by the way is now indexed, and so next year it's going to probably be $5.5 million. So when you're below that number, now it's a question of, do you want to see the money while being put to use, which my mother loves, or do you want to give it all in a lump sum just so you preserve your wealth as long as you can, is just in case you need it? And those are two different philosophies, and sometimes they're not mutually exclusive. But the good news is that you called the right place today. So I'm really glad about that, Ellen, and I hope you have a good conversation with your mother and your aunt, and that you honor whatever gifts they give you, financial gifts, and use them wisely. 404-872-0750. I'm Elise Glenk, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB. It's 55 minutes past the hour. News Talk WSB. I'm Elise Glenk, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours. 404-872-0750. Lorraine joins me on the line from Washington. Hi, Lorraine. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm calling because I wanted to know what is the appropriate way of getting a property owner's telephone number to talk to them about some concerns about someone that's renting property from them.
Well, are you in a building or are you in a house?
Oh, I live in a house. I live in a semi-detached house, and there's a house on the other side of me. We're somewhat close to each other, and this individual has issues. A young individual, it appears that his great-grandmother died and left it to his grandmother, who currently rents it to him. And he's been having wild parties. They've destroyed, vandalized a lot of my two cars. They've stolen stuff out of my cars. And I'd like to...
Why don't you call the police?
Well, I have called the police.
And what happened?
And I have talked to the police about having what they call a meeting with the police. It's like a community thing, but I wasn't able to go, which they had this recently. But in the meantime, I was reading an article in the paper, which I got the number here, and one of the advice it offered this neighbor who was having problems with a neighbor that was hacking and spitting. Did you simply call the owner of the property? Because this individual that was hacking and spending was renting property from, you know, from someone. So the advice that was given in this article that I was reading today suggested, had you tried calling the property owner and talking to them?
Right.
About the situation, in addition to talking to the individual that is causing the concerns.
Right.
Now, I've talked to the individual that's causing the concerns. It's still happening. So I think that the property owner should know that her great-grandson is causing a lot of
Okay. Have you tried looking up her phone number? Do you know her name?
Me, it's other names.
Lorraine. Lorraine, I'm trying to give you, Lorraine, I'm trying to give you advice. Can you give me a second to jump in?
Certainly. I just wanted to make sure you knew
what I understand what you're
happening.
I understand. So there are a couple of things to keep in mind. First, you can try looking up. Do you know her name?
Not really.
You can go online to the county property tax records, and you can look up the name of the person who owns the property.
But the problem is the property's still in the great-grandmother's name, not in the, because she died.
Then you can go from there. The property would have, there would have been some sort of file to transfer the ownership of the property to the next person, whether that was because she had a will or it was through probate or whatever. But you can go through the court records and track down who owns that property. And if there's a mortgage on the property, you can track it down that way. But online, you should be able to track down who owns the property, and then you can go back and see where that person is living, and you can send them a letter. You may be able, if they're a grandmother age, over 50, they probably have a real landline as opposed to just a cell phone number. But you can look up their name in the online records to then track it back and find their phone number. So there are lots of different ways that you can go, but I think calling the police again is still going to be a very effective way, because eventually that person is going to get a ticket, and that ticket is going to have to be paid, or it's going to go, you'll be able to file a lien, they will be able to file a lien against the property itself. So there are lots of things that you can try. I think it's a great idea to get in touch with the owner of the property, and these are some ways to do it. 404-872-0750. I'm Elise Klink. Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB. It's 7 minutes past the hour on the Elise Klink Show. Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB. Our number, 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. Online all the time, thinklink.com, at Glink on Twitter. Let's go back to the phones. Corey joins me on the line. Hey, Corey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Elise, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. Happy Labor Day.
Thanks, you too.
What's going on?
I need some advice from you. My wife and I purchased a foreclosure back in 2012, and we owned the house for about 25 months. I wanted to get past that two-year mark. And we flipped the house and made a substantial amount of money. Closed on the house 3 weeks after closing the house. We just closed this past May. The new owners came at me and said that the one of the two AC units went out. About 24 or 48 hours later, we received a lawsuit from them that they were suing us for $3,300 for the AC unit not working.
Okay.
So before we closed and everything, we had an inspection during the due diligence period, and then they requested another inspection 24 hours before the close of the house, and we went ahead and let them do that, and everything was fine, the inspection reports, but we still received a lawsuit. So I wanted to get some advice from you and see what you thought.
So first, I'm not a lawyer, and I don't like to play one on the radio, so just be perfectly fair, but anybody can sue anybody for anything, and this lawsuit shows that. One of the things that I often recommend to people that they do to prevent these kinds of things, because clearly, you know, even new AC units can go out.
Right.
They're 2-3 years old, they're out of warranty, but they could just fail. Things fail. And houses are expensive, and people who buy them and think they're getting some sort of a guarantee on anything, you know, are ridiculous. And it's possible or probable that this AC unit lawsuit will just get thrown out. But you'll still have to pay to defend it. So did they sue you in small claims court or in regular court?
Yes, ma'am, small claims court.
Small claims court. So you can go and you can represent yourself and say, hey, they had inspections. This is what happened. You know, houses fail. This is how it goes. And you can do that, and that's totally fine. Because they had so many inspections, I think it's going to be an open and shut case. But it's still going to take time. And you're going to have anxiety over it, and it's going to be annoying.
Right, yeah. It's been about 6 weeks since we received the lawsuit. waiting on the court date and everything. But yeah, that's kind of what we experienced. Exactly.
So you, there's a couple of other things that you could do. One is that you can call them up and say, look, I'm really sorry that this failed. You had a lot of inspections, but we're willing to meet you halfway. We'll give you, you know, $1,500. I just don't want to spend the time going to court. If you've made a lot of money on the property, maybe you want to just do that, but then they have to sign a paper that says we're done.
Sure.
And you would have a lawyer pay for that. And the whole thing would probably cost you, because you'd have to pay for the lawyer to write the letter or the agreement, probably cost you $2,000. It's not $3,300 and it's not free, but you also don't have to spend all this time going through it and dealing with it.
Right.
And lawsuits can get reported. If you get sued, it can turn up that there's a, and you lose this, right? There could be a legal judgment. You know, there's a, it's annoying to have to go through it. So
exactly.
That's a possibility. Have you tried to talk to them about that yet?
We tried to a couple times. Couldn't come to an agreement. They wanted all or nothing pretty much. So, you know, we never came to an agreement. So I told them, you know, we'll see you in court. That's, we're prepared to stick to our guns, and we know we did nothing wrong, so that's kind of our plan right now.
Okay. Well, I don't think anybody ought to be held hostage because something failed.
Sure.
One thing that you might have done, and you might think about this in the future, is for $400 or $500, you might have provided them with a home warranty.
Right.
For existing homes, which makes sure, what it does is anything that works on the day of the close, which would have been the AC unit.
Right.
If it fails in the first year after closing, it allows them to have access to sort of extra insurance.
Sure.
Where they can pay for a service call of $50, then they'll come out and either fix or replace the unit.
Okay.
And
great.
And existing home warranties are really helpful and useful. They used to be ridiculously expensive. They still don't cover everything you'd want them to cover, but they definitely cover AC units. And in your case, it would have been really helpful.
Right, exactly.
I don't know what else to tell you other than you're going to, if they are refusing to be at all, you know, reasonable about this, you're going to have to fight it. And that's annoying as anything.
That's what we're prepared to do. So, we're ready.
Well, I'm sorry it's come to this.
That's okay.
But at least you made money on the property.
Yes. Thanks for your time, Elise.
You're welcome. Have a good holiday weekend. It's 12 minutes past the hour on the Elise Kling Show. Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB, 404-872-0750. Dylan joins me on the line from Gainesville. Hi, Dylan.
Hey, Elise. How are you doing?
I'm having a good day. Good Labor Day weekend. What about you?
It's been okay. I'm a little stressed out. My wife and I moved into this apartment complex about a year ago, and 8 months ago we had new neighbors move in right next door. And since that time, they've flooded my apartment about 4 times.
No.
Yeah.
How have they done that?
You know what? I'm not really sure. I believe that what's going on is they're using a hose. They're connecting a hose to the pipe where their washer is, and they'll go outside and wash their vehicles with it. And according to the maintenance guy last night, it has been very brittle, and it just broke last night. So my apartment keeps getting flooded, spoken to management every single time it happens, and they just keep telling me, you know, they're going to keep it from happening and all this. I shouldn't have to live like that, you know?
Absolutely not. So your house gets flooded. Tell me how badly things are getting damaged? Are they paying for it? Are they coming and repainting every time this happens?
Every time that it's happened, it's leaked into the kitchen area and into the hallway. Fortunately, it hasn't hit any electronics, maybe like a laptop charger, but it does mess up the floor. Like there's some kind of hardwood layover for the floor, and it will bubble up and stuff. And last night was the only time they've ever had anybody come out and actually do something about it, and they had someone come out and suck up the water.
Uh-huh.
Last night, for instance, when this happened, my neighbors actually got into the little like compartment thing outside where they keep the pipes. They shut off the water to the entire building. Okay? That's four units.
Wow.
And it was off from 7:45 last night until about 11:30.
Huh.
Yeah. And I just don't know where to go with it from here. You know, I feel like the property manager should, you know, rectify the situation. Some kind of compensation. But I don't know where to go with it. You know, I don't know how to
All right. So one thing that may help is inside the Georgia Department of Community Affairs, there's something called the Georgia Landlord-Tenant Handbook. I assume you're in not Gainesville, Florida, right? You're in Gainesville, Georgia?
Yeah, Gainesville, Georgia.
Okay. So Georgia Landlord-Tenant Handbook. And the handbook answers common residential landlord-tenant descriptions, questions, sorry. And so it's the law as of June of 2012, so it's not completely up to date, but you can look online and it has things like landlord, tenant basics, lease and rental agreements, termination, utility issues, security deposits, and it goes through different things, and they have a section on repairs and maintenance and what's required under the law. And you may find some help there. In addition, in the DCA Office of Program and Public Affairs, they have, while they don't provide legal advice, you may be able to give them a call and talk to them about this issue and just find out. Because if your apartment is being flooded repeatedly, it may be violating a statute, and then they can either give you the information you need to break the lease, or if there's no other unit to move you to, break the lease and go find somewhere else to live. If it's a hazard, if they're putting you at risk and your family at risk, that's how you would figure that out. So have you looked at that yet?
No, I haven't looked at it. And one thing I forgot to mention, I've already verbally said that we were planning on staying for another year, and they're wanting to raise my rent per month. Like, it's not a substantial amount, but, you know, I feel like nobody else in this apartment complex has to deal with something like this. I even asked the maintenance guy last night. I was like, you know, do you have this many calls? There are these many calls to other units, and he said, no, you're the only unit.
So when is your lease up?
It's up at the end of September. So I'll be signing a new one at the end of September.
I don't think you should do that.
Okay.
I think you should move. And okay. I don't know what your lease says about giving them notice, but if it's the end of September and today is the end of August, you should see if your lease says 30 days, but I think I would call and I would just send them an email and say, hey, look, you know, we're going to move because unless you can figure out how to stop this, we're not going to pay you more money. You're flooding our place. It's a hazard. You know, we think that, you know, you're not being good landlords, and we're not going to stay in a place where we're continually getting flooded. So if you have to give them 30 days notice, I think I would send that. If you're supposed to give 60 days notice, and you said you were going to stay, I think you could say, look, this is 4 times in 4 months. We're not going to keep getting flooded every month, and you guys aren't going to fix the problem. And the problem is these guys can't behave this way, and it's a problem. Now, have you actually talked to your unit neighbors about it?
It's very difficult to speak to them about it. They're not, they don't speak very fluent English.
So okay.
It's, you know, I'm kind of at a hitting a brick wall there.
Okay. Then I think you should move, because the truth is, Dylan, life's too short. And I can't tell you how many times in my life I've used this life's just too short thing where I hit my head against the wall and I'm trying to solve a problem. And I get to the point where I realize I don't have to solve every problem. Sometimes I can take the easy way out, the so-called easy way out, because you are going to move. And you can just go and find somewhere else. If moving isn't going to be an option, then you're going to have to tell them, I'm not paying an increase in rent when I'm constantly dealing with a flood and this kind of a situation. Why don't you try that out? Check out the dca.state.ga.us. I'll put it out on Twitter so you can find the link. And then let me know in the next couple of weeks what you decide to do. 404-872-0750, 19 minutes past the hour on the Elyse Kling Show. Stay tuned. We'll be back in a moment with more on News Talk WSB. It's 26 minutes past the hour on the Elyse Kling Show. Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB. Lines are open again, 404-872-0750. Happy to chat about whatever relating to money, real estate. Mortgage interest rates fell again a little bit this week. They're at just near historic lows. This is just incredible that we are seeing somewhat of a recovery, somewhat slow recovery in the jobs market. But we are seeing mortgage interest rates stay low, and it doesn't look like they're going up anytime soon. So let's talk a little bit about that, refinancing tips and tools for you, and hopefully answer some of your questions. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. You can follow me on Twitter, at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K, go online and sign up for the free weekly newsletter at thinkglink.com, thinkglink.com. All right, I will be back in a couple of minutes. We're going to do news, weather, and traffic, of course. Lines are open, 404-872-0750. This is the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB. Minutes past the hour on the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours. Time for our prize pack giveaway. It includes a pair of tickets to see the Alliance Theater's presentation of Bull Durham, September 3rd through October 3rd at the Alliance Stage, and a pair of tickets to Rascal Flatts in concert with Sheryl Crow, September 11th at Aaron's Amphitheater at Lakewood, produced by Live Nation. Prize pack value is $188. We'll give it away to the fifth caller at 404-741-0750, 404-741-0750. Be nice to Andrew. He is taking your call. Good luck. All right, 37 minutes past the hour on the Elise Glink Show. While we let people call in for that, I want to talk about mortgage interest rates. This week, about 4.1% for a 30-year fixed-rate loan. The 15-year is around 3.5%. And this is, again, for people who have scores at the highest levels. And the highest levels is interesting because it's a lot higher than it used to be. So if you used to have a 720, and that was considered to be in the best credit score area, now it's 740. If it was 740, it's now 760 or 780. And so the requirements for the very best, these credit, the mortgage rates that you hear us talking about all the time, those rates are for the people who now have 740, 750, 760, 780 credit scores. And for people who have lower credit scores, it's not as good. Although, what we are seeing, which is sort of interesting, is that current mortgage rates are dropping for people who have FICO scores of 580. So, we haven't seen people with credit scores below 600 or 620 even be able to get mortgages. And now, if you've got a credit score at about 580, we're seeing that there are loans that are available to you. You, maybe you're not getting 4%, but you're getting a pretty decent amount. One of the things that we are seeing is that the average credit score on closed loans is going down. It's now 727, according to Dan Green's column this week, 10 points lower than a year ago. Mortgage interest rates are their best rates in basically a year, a little over a year, and so you've got the chance to refinance. Very important to take advantage of this when you can. The latest numbers are showing that you may see mortgage interest rates up a year from now over 5.2%. Now, I know at the beginning of this year, I already thought, and so did every other economist I talked to, mortgage interest rates would have already been over 5%, and yet that hasn't happened. Why? Well, I think it has to do with the fact that the Fed hasn't ended its bond buying program when it said it was, which was like September 13. We're still at it today, a year later. The economy is not really where it is, where you want it to be, where you feel comfortable about it. We're seeing no wage growth whatsoever. And in fact, wages on an inflation-adjusted basis are down over the last 10, 20 years. People are not making more money. In fact, somebody said to me in the mortgage industry, what we really have now is an income problem. We have an income problem because people simply are not making enough money to be able to afford the loan. And what I've been saying since 2007 and 2006 is that jobs and real estate are so closely tied together. There's no other way for you to actually get a loan if you don't have the income you need to pay the bill every month. You have to do it. There's something in the law now called the ability to repay rule, and lenders are required to look at your ability to repay. It's not enough to have a great credit score and a pulse. That worked for a really long time, or you could say it didn't work for a really long time. Credit scores, FICO or Vantage, any of the credit scores that are out there, failed to do is they failed to provide an accurate forecast of what would happen when people actually lost their jobs en masse and the economy tanked. Some of the information coming out this week that I read about those scary days in 2007, end of 2007 into 2008, where the economy was said to be in complete free fall for a two-week period as everybody scrambled around wondering how many agencies and how many companies were literally going to go under in the course of 2 weeks. And it could have been 13 of 15 that were being looked at. It's crazy. So here we are, a whole bunch of years later, and the economy still isn't back to where it was. But one thing that is interesting to think about is, what is the new normal? What is the new normal going to look like for mortgage origination? What is the new normal going to look like for housing numbers, new construction numbers? It's clearly not going to be where we were at the top. So when we talk about not being near where we were at the top of the marketplace, we're still down a whole lot. But what does new normal look like? So 7, 8 years later, we have a whole lot of fewer people buying houses. Is the new normal going to be 4.4 million existing homes sold and maybe 750 new homes sold? Is that the new number? Is it going to be a million new homes sold? What is the number, the new normal, going to be? Meanwhile, when it comes to mortgages, the new normal seems to be we're doing better and expanding more, and we're, if you've got a credit score, a FICO credit score under 640, you can now get a loan. It's going to be a FICO, an FHA loan, government-backed, and the mortgage rate on that is going down, and that's actually great news. So there are ways to get loans. There are ways to still buy a house, and all of that is pretty darn interesting. Another thing that we did this week, and I'm going to be writing about it probably this week in one of my columns, is what's happening for consumers with their credit scores and the newly announced FICO 9 credit score. So the way FICO works, Fair Isaacs, is they have a couple of algorithms, and what they do is they mishmash that together, and they look at how well you pay your loans, how many different kinds of lines of credit you have open, and a whole bunch of other things, and they put it together and mix it up, and that's your credit score. Well, the FICO credit score that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are using are not the latest version. So you might say to yourself, why not? That's a good question. So we went out and asked that question this week. We talked to some people at Freddie Mac. We talked to some people at FICO. We talked to some other kinds of lenders. We talked to some credit reporting bureaus. And it's really interesting. FICO is still supporting the original credit score. That credit score is being used by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, so 90%+ of homes that are being financed are using the regular FICO score. Last year, I think it was FICO 8 was introduced and then FICO 9, and what our contacts in the credit industry are telling us is that it takes a really long time to understand how a new version of credit scores will work in predicting risk as the existing credit score. And that could take a year or two to do that kind of testing on the numbers. So the new credit score that FICO introduced a week or two ago is supposed to put less emphasis on unpaid medical bills, for example. And it's going to take lenders, and there's some other improvements that they made and enhancements to the credit score. It's going to take lenders a year or two to validate whether putting less emphasis on medical bills and medical debts will translate into a meaningful difference in how well people pay their mortgages and credit card bills and auto loans. Now, if you're like me, you're going, really? It's going to take you a year or two to validate that? And yet that's what they're telling us. And so because FICO is still supporting its original credit scores back from, I think it's 2006, before, right? 2006 was before the housing crisis, before the economy fell apart, before the weeks of free fall. Because they're still supporting that credit score, that's the one that all the lenders are using. And it's a lot of time and a lot of money to validate a new credit score, even if the credit score is better. So FICO is trying to prove that its credit score, new credit score, is better. The one that places less emphasis on medical debts, the one that also changes around, I'm trying to say this in the right way, changes around how non-traditional credit is validated, right? Because that's also a change. And when you look at all of these different changes in credit scores, and credit scores govern everything, right? Insurance, they govern your auto loans, they govern some of your investments. Your credit score and your credit history are key. So we know about that, right? But when you've got trillions of dollars, depending on whether a credit score is right or not right, and you're making trillion-dollar bets on mortgage portfolios, I guess you're just a little more careful. So then the question is, well, why does FICO keep introducing these new credit scores if nobody is picking them up and nobody is using them? And that apparently is where they are with FICO 9. I don't even know if anybody's using the FICO 8 score. So we talked to some people in the government because everybody said, well, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac said, well, if somebody's going to require us in the government to use these new scores, then we're going to put some money and effort towards validating them. But the government doesn't seem inclined to change that either, even though we're now past the worst part of the housing recession for sure, and we're trying to bring all these people back into the marketplace, and all kinds of people are saying we don't even need to own a house anymore. It's silly. And so there are structural changes. And yet nobody from the government is willing to step up and say, right, we think you should evaluate this new credit score because we like the idea of placing less emphasis on medical debts, which could really arise from a question of who pays what, not I don't have the means or want to pay you, but I thought my insurance company was paying that $200 bill. The insurance company says, no, you're paying this $200 bill. And now what about people who have just been renting? How do you validate the renting? How do you validate the 80% of expenses that you have every single month that don't even hit your credit score? Those are the kinds of questions it would be really interesting to find out if the FICO 9 is actually going to make a change and emphasize those or not. But until one lender decides to use it, I guess we're not going to know. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. I'm Elise Glink. This is the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time on WSB. It's 56 minutes past the hour on the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB. So we've reached nearly the end of the show, and I want to give a shout out to my cousins, Zach and Abby, who are getting married today. And we're driving up to this wedding in Wisconsin after the show. And what's really so special about young people getting married today is the idea that, and I think back because today is the 27th anniversary of the day I met Sam. We just had our 25th wedding anniversary. And I think back to when we were starting out and when all young couples are starting out, and somebody said to me, well, what's the number one piece of advice, financial advice, that you would give a young couple today? And I think that it boils down to something that Sam and I discovered over years, which is that money, and this is just going to sound ridiculous, but money doesn't make for a happy life. Money gives you options. Money allows you to make decisions you might not otherwise have made. Money certainly can make life easier in a lot of ways. But money alone isn't what makes you happy. happy is something you have to work at every single day. And if it isn't going to be happy, it's going to be content. And being content with what you have, not wanting what you think everybody else has that you want to have, right? It's all an, that stuff's all an illusion. And so when I say to a young couple, you know, be happy with what you have, right? Be content with what you have and want what you do have, right? Don't lust for money. Don't think that it's going to be the be-all, game-all. Start there. And it really is interesting, especially when you're young and you don't own property and you don't have headaches and you don't have a lot of debt, or even if you do have a lot of debt, focusing on the things that are going to make you happy, often which are free, is the way to go. This lovely couple that we're going to celebrate their wedding today, they are a couple that focuses on the basics. They, you know, rent a very modest apartment. They work for startups. They are focused on each other and not on acquiring all kinds of things. And they've got a whole long life, hopefully, ahead of them. And so my wishes are for everybody who has celebrated a wedding in this summer or who is going to before the end of the year, pick the one thing that makes you happy. Be happy with that. Focus on the things that you can control, not things that are out of your control. And at the very bottom line, remember why it is you decided to marry what I hope is your best friend. Because over time, life gets long, and there are a lot of challenges along the way. And at least if you're fighting on the same team with your best friend, it makes the whole thing so much better. So congratulations to this couple that we're going to, and best wishes to all of you for a happy Labor Day. I hope it is fun and meaningful and you have a great time. Enjoy and relax. Recharge for the week ahead. I'll be back next Sunday, back at 11 to 1. I think the dogs are off next Sunday, and then we continue into full-time football mode. Have a great week, everybody, and a happy Labor Day.